Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI. Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. I mean, if you know literature, you just know that line. It's more than just an opening, isn't it, feels like?
Yeah.
Well, like stepping straight into a dream, or maybe a nightmare.
Absolutely. It casts this immediate shadow, this sense of nostalgia mixed with dread. You know right away that Manderley, whatever it was, is lost. It only exists in this sort of haunted memory space.
Exactly. So today, we're diving deep into Daphne du Maurier's 1938 masterpiece, Rebecca.
It really is a masterpiece. And our goal, I think, is to unpack why it still holds such power, why it's considered such a cornerstone of psychological suspense.
Right. We want to explore its haunting atmosphere, sure, but also dig into themes like, you know, the fragility of identity and how the past can just grip you and not let go. We're going beyond just the plot points here.
Definitely. And to really get it, you need a bit of context on du Maurier herself, born 1907, right? And her family background is fascinating, very artistic, very theatrical. Her grandfather was Georges du Maurier, the novelist.
You can feel that theatrical sensibility in her writing, can't you? The way she builds atmosphere, the drama of it all.
Oh, completely. And the timing. 1938, just before World War II.
Yeah.
There's this undercurrent of global anxiety, this feeling that things might look okay on the surface, but are unstable underneath. That really permeates the novel.
Like Manderley itself. Beautiful, but crumbling psychologically.
Precisely. And she uses the Cornish landscape, you know, that rugged, brooding coast, almost like another character. It reflects the narrator's isolation, her internal state.
And she wasn't just sticking to one genre, was she? It's gothic, yes, the big mysterious house, the brooding Maxim de Winter,
yeah. But
it feels so much more modern.
That's the genius blend. It's gothic romance meets psychological thriller. The ghosts aren't supernatural. They're memories. They're psychological pressures.
And it worked. Rebecca was a smash hit instantly.
Yeah.
Never been out of print, which is amazing. And of course, it led to that iconic Hitchcock film in 1940. It really cemented her reputation.
Okay, so let's get into the story. It starts in Monte Carlo. We meet our narrator, and crucially, she remains unnamed throughout the entire book.
Right, which is such a key point later on.
She's working as a paid companion to this awful, vulgar woman, Mrs. Van Hopper, living this life she calls genteel servitude. She's young, incredibly shy, insecure.
Yeah, she paints a picture of someone just fading into the background until she meets Maxime de Winter, wealthy, older, sophisticated widower.
And it's a whirlwind courtship. He proposes, marries her, basically rescues her from that dreary life. But even then, you sense the power dynamic is off.
Definitely. He's the rescuer. She's the grateful recipient. It's maybe not quite love, more like escape for her.
Perhaps. And then they arrive at Manderley, the beautiful estate on the Cornish coast, and the dream, well, it pretty quickly curdles into a psychological nightmare.
Because Manderley isn't just a house.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's a shrine.
Exactly. A shrine to the first Mrs. de Winter, Rebecca. Everything, the routines, the objects, the staff's loyalty, it all revolves around preserving Rebecca's memory. Her presence is overwhelming, even in death.
And the chief guardian of that shrine, Mrs. Danvers. Ugh. One of literature's truly chilling figures.
She really is. She's the head housekeeper, but she's more like the living embodiment of the past's suffocating power. Her devotion to Rebecca is intense, obsessive.
It feels almost unnatural, doesn't it? That level of devotion.
It does. And it manifests as this relentless campaign of psychological cruelty against the new Mrs. de Winter. Danvers uses comparison, suggestion, these subtle little torments to constantly undermine her.
Which brings us right to that core struggle, identity. The narrator's namelessness is just brilliant symbolism, isn't it?
It perfectly captures her whole crisis. She's trying desperately to carve out a space for herself, to be someone, but she's constantly overshadowed by Maxim's world and, overwhelmingly, by Rebecca's ghost.
Her motivation seems so simple, almost painfully so. She just wants to belong, to be loved. But she doesn't even seem to know who she is, separate from that need.
And Maxim, he's the classic Byronic hero type, right? Brooding, sophisticated, magnetic, but oh, those dark secrets and sudden bursts of rage.
Tormented. And his inability or maybe unwillingness to communicate properly just ramps up all the tension. He's so emotionally closed off for so much of the book.
Which leaves the narrator feeling even more isolated and inadequate. And then there's Rebecca herself, the absent presence.
She dominates everything, even though she's dead. Initially, she's built up as this paragon, beautiful, charming, accomplished, the perfect hostess, an impossible ideal.
Utterly impossible. And that's the point. The narrator isn't just competing with a memory. She's competing with a myth. an idealized perfection that probably never even existed quite like that.
So the central conflict isn't really just about Maxim, is it? It's this battle between the narrator and Mrs. Danders, fought over the territory of Manderley, but ultimately it's a battle against Rebecca's ghost for her own sense of self.
You've nailed it. It's about the destructive power of comparison, how an idealized past can just poison the present.
Okay, so things really escalate, Telstra.
Yeah.
The tension keeps building until that infamous Manderley costume ball.
Ah, yes. The narrator decides to revive this grand tradition, you know, trying to step into her role as mistress of the house. She needs a costume.
And she makes the mistake of asking Mrs. Danvers for advice. It's just brutal.
It's pure psychological warfare disguised as helpfulness. Danvers suggests a specific, beautiful white gown from a family portrait. Innocent enough, right?
Except
it's the exact same dress Rebecca wore to her last ball. Danvers sets her up for maximum public humiliation.
Walking down that grand staircase, thinking she looks elegant, and then seeing Maxim's face.
Yeah.
The horror. His reaction is just terrifying rage, cold, absolute fury.
It's the emotional low point, a complete disaster, and it pushes the narrator to the brink. Mrs. Danvers finds her vulnerable and almost talks her into jumping from the window.
That scene is so claustrophobic, the power suggestion.
It's chilling. But just as Danvers is about to succeed, there's an interruption. A commotion outside flares over the bay.
A ship's run aground in the fog, right? And during the rescue efforts, divers discover something else entirely.
Rebecca's boat, scuttled, sunk deliberately. And inside her body, which forces the real truth to finally surface.
Because the official story was that she drowned accidentally while sailing, wasn't it? Her body washed ashore miles away and was identified by Maxim.
Correct. But this discovery changes everything. It means the body Maxim identified wasn't Rebecca's. It triggers a new inquest, and under pressure, Maxim confesses to the narrator.
And the confession is just staggering. He didn't love Rebecca. He hated her.
Hated her. He reveals their marriage was a total sham, a performance for the public. Rebecca, he says, wasn't the charming ideal everyone thought. She was cruel, manipulative, utterly amoral.
Taunting him with affairs.
Openly. And the final provocation, she told him she was pregnant with another man's child, but that she'd raise it as the De Winter heir, trapping him completely.
So in a fit of rage,
he shot her, put her body in the boat, sailed it out, and sank it. Then later identified an unknown body as hers to close the case. It's a shocking revelation. Murder.
But here's the twist, the psychological genius of it. This confession. It doesn't destroy the narrator. It liberates her.
It seems so counterintuitive, right? Your husband is a murderer.
But think about it. She spent the whole novel fighting a ghost, an ideal of perfection she could never match. Now, Maxim has shattered that myth. He's shown her the real Rebecca, monstrous, hateful. And he's shown the narrator his vulnerability, his truth.
Ah, so the impossible ideal is gone. And she realizes she prefers the flawed, human Maxim, even a murderous one who needs her, to the distant, tormented man haunted by a perfect ghost.
Exactly. Her insecurity just melts away. She becomes his partner, his fierce protector. Her love becomes adult, active. She's ready to fight with him to protect their secret.
So they're united, finally. But the danger isn't over. There's the inquest.
And Rebecca's slimy cousin, Jack Favell, who was also her lover, he suspects Maxim and tries blackmail. Things get very tense legally. It looks like Maxim might actually be exposed.
But Du Maurier saves the most audacious twist for last. The investigation turns up Rebecca's apartment book, leading them to a London doctor she visited shortly before her death.
And the doctor reveals the final, crucial piece of the puzzle. Rebecca wasn't pregnant.
Not pregnant at all. In fact, she was terminally ill. Cancer. She only had months to live, and it would have been a painful decline.
So she engineered her own death.
Precisely. Knowing she was dying, she provoked Maxim, goaded him into killing her. It was her final act of malice, ensuring he would be destroyed, hanged for her murder, even after she was gone. Pure sociopathy.
Unbelievable. And of course, this revelation about the illness provides Maxim with a plausible, non-murderous explanation in the eyes of the law. They assume she killed herself because of the diagnosis.
Right. The motive for Maxim to murder her evaporates, legally speaking. The case collapses. They walk free.
Free, but not unscathed. As they drive back towards Manderley, relieved but forever changed, they see it.
The glow on the horizon. Manderley is on fire.
A horrifying apocalyptic sight. It's never stated explicitly, but the implication is overwhelming. Mrs. Danvers, her final act of devotion to Rebecca, or perhaps revenge, destroying the place, destroying the past.
So they escape legal justice, but they lose Manderley, their home, everything. They're forced into this permanent haunted exile we glimpse at the very beginning of the book.
Wow. So stepping back, the major theme has to be appearance versus reality, doesn't it? Nothing at Manderley is what it seems. Not Rebecca, not Maxim, not the house itself. It's all a facade.
Absolutely. And tied to that is the theme of identity. The narrator's namelessness highlights her struggle to define herself, to find her own worth outside of Rebecca's shadow or Maxim's protection. She has to learn that her own imperfect self is more valuable than some false ideal.
Manderley itself feels like a symbol of the power of memory, maybe. How the past, especially an idealized or distorted past, can utterly consume the present. You can't just erase it, you have to confront it.
And the moral ambiguity is just fascinating. Du Maurier manipulates us, the readers, into rooting for Maxim, a killer, because Rebecca is presented as so monstrous. It forces you to question what justice really means when the victim was the true villain.
The first-person narration is key to that manipulation, too. We're trapped in the narrator's head, feeling her fear, her insecurity. It creates such powerful dramatic irony because we only know what she knows or thinks she knows.
Definitely. And the symbolism throughout Manderley as both paradise and prison, the sea hiding secrets, those vivid blood-red rhododendrons representing beauty and danger, it's so richly layered.
I think Rebecca resonates so deeply because at its heart, it's about comparison. That corrosive feeling of inadequacy, of never measuring up, especially when you step into a role someone else defined. Everyone feels that sometimes, right?
True. And maybe it teaches us that choosing truth, even a difficult, ugly truth, and finding loyalty within that imperfection is ultimately more valuable than chasing a flawless illusion. But that choice, it often comes at a huge cost.
So here's a final thought. Manderley is destroyed. A final terrible act. But given Rebecca's ultimate goal was to destroy Maxim entirely, did the fire mean she won in the end? Or did its destruction paradoxically free Maxim and the narrator to finally build a real life together, even in exile, away from her overpowering legacy?
That's the lingering question, isn't it? Is exile a punishment or the only possible path to freedom for them?
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.